My interest in this subject is because of my public-facing work in the House of Lords, and in particular over the last few years developing an interest in AI. And I now plot engagement with artificial intelligence increasingly on an axis from the Terminator robot that you see there to something much more simple and mundane, but much more real. Most newspaper articles about AI, whatever the subject, it seems, put the Terminator robot on as a picture, because it's been found you get more clicks if you can, whatever your story is about, if you put the headline, "Robots are taking over the world," you'll get far more people clicking on your story. And when I first began to engage with this subject, a couple of years ago, seriously, the stuff that kept me awake at night was the artificial general intelligence robot conscious machine end of the spectrum. I think I've been doing it about a year before the stuff that really began to keep me awake at night was not the stuff that might or might not happen in an indeterminate period of time by way of artificial general intelligence. It's the stuff that's happening now that keeps me awake at night. For public awareness of issues of AI is a very long way behind what the technology is already doing. And one of my reflections on fantastic inputs that I've heard today, but a lot of the conversation has focused around this end of the spectrum and understandable speculation about conscious machines. What we ought to be concerned about much more acutely is the stuff that's happening now, and the very ordinary thing that most of us will have in our pockets that I've put on your right of the screen, the Tesco Club Card, has become my symbol of that. Tesco Club Card was invented in 1994, and so it's quite old technology now, but of course it's become ever more sophisticated. And it's there as a symbol of the way in which humankind, almost universally, is trading data about ourselves in a way which is unrecognized, and which has been suggested future generations will look back on in the same way that we look back on Native Americans trading land for beads and trinkets in the early years of the colonization of the United States. We have no idea of the value of our data. House of Lords Select Committee is a tremendous experience for learning. So for a year, I got to sit on it and talk to people and quiz people who came to give evidence to our committee. And our report was published just a few months ago, AI in the UK, Ready, Willing and Able. It is to be debated in Parliament in 9 days' time, if you want to follow that online. It was a well-received report so far, and we'll see how the debate is received, and some of its recommendations are going forward in different ways. But out of that work and engagement, these are my... that's not a very legible slide for you, probably, but these are my top 9 issues about artificial intelligence in the present. And very few of them are at the Terminator robot end of the spectrum. The first is public awareness, debate, scrutiny and trust lags a long way behind what the technology is now doing, which I've touched on. The second is public truth and political debate is being shaped in real and often obscure ways. The story was told earlier this year of Cambridge Analytica in the public domain, but one of the consequences of our giving away our data is that we are vulnerable to persuasion in different ways. The majority of it commercial persuasion, persuading us to buy stuff, but very real also is political persuasion, and it's clear that data-driven, AI-driven political campaigning shaped and influenced the last two American presidential elections, the last general election in the UK, and probably the EU referendum as well. Something we should be majorly concerned with. The third is AI and the future of work, which is really significant. There are different predictions about how it will affect the UK, except we know that this technology will be disruptive and potentially more disruptive than previous similar industrial revolutions. There was a story in the newspapers over the summer of a warehouse near Manchester employing 5,000 people, which is being replaced by an identical warehouse near Leicester. I think it's the Littlewoods Group that were doing this particular rebuilding. 5,000 jobs in Manchester replaced by 2,000 jobs in Leicester in the warehousing industry. The call center industry and warehousing will be the next to be disrupted by this technology, but it will go on unfolding with a bias towards the technologies for least skilled, but certainly affecting white-collar work as we go forward. It's not known, and all kinds of factors will affect this, how many new roles will replace the old roles, jobs we haven't thought about yet. But this is a really disruptive technology. And the fourth theme, education, is key. Preparing past and future generations for a different future. Anthony Seldon, Vice Chancellor of Buckingham University, has done a very good book recently on education and AI, and describes education as the Cinderella of artificial intelligence thinking and reflection. Anthony thinks AI has the potential to completely transform what we see in the classroom and university at the present time. Data issues are really significant. How we manage our data, how we conceive our data, how we make the best use of our data. How we grow the AI economy in the UK. Weaponization has been touched on today. It's a reality. There is an international campaign with the United Nations at present to limit the use of autonomous weapons, which do already exist in different ways. The UK at the moment does not share the definitions used by the rest of the world and is not participating fully in that debate. The sectorization of machines is a key strand in this, and because of its commercial potential, is likely to be a driver, as the dark web has been a driver for the internet. And questions of leadership, who shapes the future, who benefits from the technology, what is the role of government, what is the role of public debate and civil society? Can we escape from technological or economic determinism, which says that technology can do this, therefore it must be good, to a more moderated and principled public debate? One of the things we heard again and again in the Select Committee from every different part of the AI community was we need to engage seriously with ethics, and that our engagement with AI needs to be ethically led and driven. And the only thing I'll share with you from the report is our five principles, which we developed as something to discuss, really, and think about and knock down and improve, but as principles that we thought should form or could form the heart of an ethical AI policy. That artificial intelligence should be developed for the common good and benefit of humanity. that AI should operate on principles of intelligibility and fairness. A huge issue is bias in the use of data, particularly if AI is used, as it now is used, in, for example, judicial sentencing policies, human resources policy, determination of whether you can have a loan or not. If the data sets are biased against you because of your colour or gender or class or education, that's going to affect your life in significant ways. Artificial intelligence should not be used to diminish the data rights and privacy of individuals, families, or communities. All citizens have the right to be educated to enable them to flourish mentally, emotionally, and economically alongside artificial intelligence. And the autonomous power to hurt, destroy, or deceive human beings should never be vested in artificial intelligence. The UK aspires to be, the UK government, aspires to be an international leader in the ethics of artificial intelligence. I'm enormously comforted and encouraged by that. The government feels we have a significant part to play. And looking at the development of artificial intelligence globally, we are not in the UK at the level of investment of some of the other great centres of excellence. But we do have a chance to make an ethical contribution. And we are a reasonable third or fourth in terms of levels of investment. The majority of investment comes from Silicon Valley, and the second largest investor now globally is China. Both are bringing diametrically different sets of ethics to the table, both deeply unsatisfactory. If there is going to be an ethical lead in AI, it will probably emerge from within Europe, and I think Britain has a good place in that going forward. Before I end with some theological reflection, three books that haven't been mentioned today at all, very good books have, but I thought might be interesting to you as coming from a more general perspective. I've just read Hannah Fry's book, Hello World, How to Be Human in the Age of the Machine. And if you're not aware of some of the effects of this technology, I would really commend it to you. Hannah can also be seen on television, and she presented the absolutely excellent Horizon programme on television about 10 days ago on the very disturbing incursions of Babylon into the National Health Service GP provision in inner London. I think I know this field a little now, and I didn't know that if you live in inner London, you can sign up for an AI-driven GP service with appointments on Skype, and that's good for you if you're a young, fit Londoner. If you're a GP trying to run a practice in Stepney, it's creaming off your healthiest patients. The technology is good. The way it's being used to privatise the National Health Service is disturbing, I think. The middle book, World Without Mind, is Franklin Foer's book. He's a journalist, and it's a trip through the ethical and philosophical roots of Silicon Valley and Facebook and Google and the people and Apple and the people who've created these companies, and tracing back their ethical foundation to the extreme libertarianism of California in the 1960s, and the way in which that affects the tech companies today. And the third writer, Yuval Noah Harari, will be familiar perhaps from his two earlier books, Sapiens, which is a quite magisterial overview of the history of the species, Homo Deus, which is a projection forward into the future, and his recent book, which is much more uneven, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, which attempts to look at the present and some of the features of humanity. One of Harari's fundamental insights about Homo sapiens, which I find persuasive, is the importance of a story in order to enable collective endeavor. that in any group of more than 150 people, he argues, story and meaning is necessary for collaboration. The tension in Harari is that at the same time as saying story and fiction is vital, he systematically deconstructs the foundational stories of meaning which have enabled that endeavor. And I think he is a good writer to catch something of the spirit of the age in terms of our quest for meaning. The big question, as we've been looking at all day, for these AI developments at the club card end of the spectrum, as well as the more speculative developments, is what does it mean to be human? This is Kevin Kelly, one of the writers I first read on the subject, editor of Wired magazine and other things. We will spend the next three decades, indeed perhaps the next century, in a permanent identity crisis, asking what humans are good for. The greatest benefit, he says, of the arrival of artificial intelligence is that AIs will help define humanity. We need AI to help tell us who we are. Occasionally, when I articulate my interest in these things, I see thought bubbles form above people's heads. It's one of your gifts as a bishop, is knowing what's in people's mind. And the thought bubble for, I'm joking there, of course. And the thought bubble most often I see forming, I imagine forming, is what on earth have you got to say to this debate, particularly when I'm in Parliament? What on earth has a bishop got to contribute to this debate? And sometimes it's asked explicitly, do you mind if I ask you the question? And what I say in response is, well, I think I'm here as a representative of a faith which dares to believe that God became a person. Therefore, I think we have something to contribute to the debate on what it means to be human. God became a human person, and that fundamentally shifts our understanding of who we are and the new questions which have come. So, using the enormous resources in our tradition to respond to these questions, as some of our speakers are doing brilliantly this morning, among the best I've heard, is absolutely essential for us. And if I can leave you just with one resource, which for me is a powerful and... I was going to do two, but I'll just do one. A powerful portrait of what it means to be human. These are the Beatitudes from the Gospel of Matthew. They stand at the head of the greatest sermon in the history of humankind, the Sermon on the Mount. They're the first words Jesus speaks almost in the Gospel of Matthew, the first substantial words. And they can be seen in two different ways. There are two questions to ask of the Beatitudes in Matthew. The first is, what picture do they paint of the person who speaks them? They are a portrait of the character of Christ. And second, what picture do they give of what it means to be human and to be a person? And I think the two are obviously connected. But actually, their vision in the Beatitudes of what it means to be human is profound. That to be human is about dependence on God in relationship, to be poor in spirit. That there's something about being authentically human which is centered in humility. That there's something about being human which takes suffering seriously and embraces lament and mourning as an integral feature of our humanity and of human life and of compassion for the other. That there's something about being human which is about longing for the world to be better, and for justice for everyone. The quality of mercy is to the highest to which we can aspire. A purity and single-mindedness, which in the context of the Sermon on the Mount is about personal authenticity and being on the inside what we are on the outside, is hugely important. To be peacemakers and to aim for reconciliation. And the goal of all things is all creation reconciled in Christ. And to be prepared to hold on to what we believe, no matter the cost of that, is also an integral part of what it means to live well as human beings. You, in your role as scientists, have a deep and vital vocation, both to do the science well, if I may say so, and also to engage in the biblical and theological reflection that the world needs at this moment in our history, as much as it, if not more, than at any other. And that reflection will flow into and from the portrait of Christ in the Gospels and in the tradition, the one who captures for us what it means to be human. Thank you.